but when I demanded that he catch his breath, he did. That is when bullets shot right through the middle of the opening in our horseshoe position, only inches away from my friends and me. Everyone hugged the sandbag walls, and fortunately, no one got hit. Two more bursts followed. My friend, Hamby, a.k.a. Hambone, was not wounded, and I was not wounded badly, so it was up to us to cover all directions to protect the rest. That insurgent that almost shot me from the window and nearly killed people a few other times really got me pissed. I yelled at Hambone to put an M203 grenade right in the second-story window. He only had a flare and one HE high-explosive round left. They were under each of his armpits on his belt, but I was unsure if he knew it. I yelled several times for him to shoot at that window with no response. Finally, he did. He grabbed the flare first, maybe by accident, and shot it right in the window, a perfect hit. Lots of smoke billowed out from the window, but he was not burned out. I waited to kill him when he jumped, but that did not happen. Then Hambone snagged the HE and shot again, another perfect placement. We never saw or heard from that insurgent again. I assumed he was dead, though I never saw the round kill him. Rested, Hansen said, "We need to get more ammo out of the Humvees." I thought for a moment how crazy it would be to leave this protection, but the greater good was to get us and others more ammo so we could keep fighting. I took another deep breath before we departed. I don't know why taking a big breath helps me to decide to do something that is going to probably kill me, but I always did it. My new job was to kill anyone trying to kill Hansen as he got the ammo from the back of the Humvee, so our guys would not kill us, since nerves and reflexes were raw and deadly. We dashed toward the vehicles, yelling, "Friendlies, don't shoot!" Hansen got into the back of a Humvee and yanked out our speedballs, or rapid emergency amounts of ammo. These were specially made up for moments like this. Grenades, M4 ammo, saw ammo, M203 grenades, and 7.62mm linked M240 machine gun ammo filled the top of the ammo cans. They were heavy on a normal day, but Hansen and I slung them around like they weighed nothing. Right then, an odd thought crossed my mind. I wished I could always have the super strength I had right then. It lasted until the end of the battle. On the way back to our hole, I got caught in some brush. I was trying to use it as concealment, but it was too thick and caught me up. It took all of me to barrel through it. A Marine and Afghan Army soldier was now in our hole. The Afghan was terrified and only had one mag for his AK-47. I told him to look east, put his weapon on semi, and shoot anyone that looked dangerous to us. I am sure he had no clue what I was saying, and I was worried that he might shoot one of our guys. He was too scared to focus, and I had to yell at him every 5 minutes to scan his sector. I don't know if Afghans even know what a sector is. The firefight was so intense, the Marine had no time to shoot. He was reloading mags as fast as he could for me and others, so we could stay alive and not get overrun. Then I got to my position and started to return fire. So as not to get hit, I had to get so low that I was blowing away the top layer of sandbags with my weapon. I could not believe my eyes. First platoon, chosen company, arrived in four Humvees, their guns blazing. It was the first moment I thought our platoon, or what was left of it, might have a chance. A U.S. soldier was walking in front, trying to find an American to talk to. Sergeant Hisong ran out, and I heard the soldier ask him, "Where are they at?" Sergeant Hisong replied with something like, "They're everywhere." Specialist Green and Specialist Tinnan came to my hole at the TCP near the FOB. It was good to have them fighting alongside of us. The four Humvees started to lay down some serious firepower, and the tide of the battle felt like it began to change. Still, the enemy did not let up. We kept fighting from that hole, and one Humvee pushed through one aught to the north, where the enemy was funneling in. That Humvee, along with the dismounts, cleared most of the mud huts around us, killing any enemy that was holed up. When the enemy tried to break contact with their wounded, the Apache helicopters started to have a field day by killing them in every direction. I saw Hambone and asked why he came to the TCP from one of the Humvees. He told me the bad guy shot a bullet right through the feed tray of his 50-cal machine gun while he was reloading it. It was close enough to kill him, but fortunately it hit the gun instead. Word came that artillery was on the way, 155-millimeter shells from FOB Blessing, about 7 or 8 kilometers away. Sergeant Hisong told us to lay flat. I knew it was going to be bad because it was going to be danger close. I heard Apaches doing their gun runs with 30-millimeter cannons and rockets. I honestly thought I was going to die from our own guys. We had to throw smoke grenades and bright VS-17 panels up in trees so the pilots could tell us from the enemy. I lay flat and put my face deep into the dirt. I started to dig with my fingers to get deeper, but the ground was solid. I braced myself for the big rounds to hit. I hoped one would hit me directly or not get hit at all. The earth exploded, and my body lifted off the ground about an inch or two. I did a quick check for shrapnel. I was not hurt. Sergeant Hisong yelled for people to go back up to the OP topside. I said I would, because that was my plan, and I had 8 hand grenades on my chest and 2 cans of 7.62 link ammo for the M240 machine gun anyway. I was wounded, and my wounds were starting to hurt again, but I knew we had to get back up there. Green and Tenon from 1st Platoon wanted to go with me. That's when Sergeant Hisong said this. They're all dead, McCabe. He had to say it again before it registered with me. He said if Sergeant Gobble, Stafford, and I had not come down when we did, we would be dead too. This scared the shit out of me. But again, anger fueled me to fight. He told me not to look at the bodies when I got there, and I said I wouldn't. I really thought I would obey that order, as I had no desire to see dead friends. I told Tenon and Green they would have to protect me on the way up and back down, because I could not carry a weapon and all the ammo too. I knew the safest route up, but it was uphill and no cover other than a shin-deep trench. It would have to do because that's all we had. I was in the middle, with one guy to my rear and the other at my front. When we got to the OP, we found it destroyed. This was the first time I looked at it from the outside. I started handing out grenades and ammo when I saw all my dead friends. I did not want to look, but I did. Why? I have no idea to this day. How cruel bullets can be. Some were partly in black body bags, some were all the way in, and a few were not in a bag at all. My mind clouded and my emotions went raw, cold. I could not believe what I was seeing. Something changed in me right then. So I started tossing hand grenades to my buddy, who was in my old position. He had come up earlier to help us. Staff Sergeant Phillips was up with a Marine on the M240 machine gun, so I gave him the ammo cans before we made it back down to the TCP again. For his actions that day, Staff Sergeant Phillips would receive a Distinguished Service Cross, the second highest medal for valor. My party of 3 made it back down, and the battle raged for another hour or so. Then the shooting slowed and finally stopped. U.S. Special Forces and Afghan commandos searched and cleared the surrounding area for bad guys, found some, killed them. As I left, Battle Company and Naval Company platoons and scouts showed up. I heard over the net, "Is there anyone else wounded or KIA that needs to get out of here?" Sergeant Hisong mentioned my name, but I told him I was okay and still able to fight, though I knew I was not. I was then given a direct order from my company commander, Captain Myers, to get on the next bird out. Staff Sergeant Phillips helped my sorry ass to the bird, and I was off. I saw Stafford lying on the floor of the bird, moaning and wanting water. The crew chief said not to give him any, though I had a bottle of it. So I filled the cap of my bottle 3 times for him and put it on his cracked lips. He was crying and kept telling me sorry and thank you for saving his life. I was crying too, as it all hit me at once. I told him to just worry about getting better. I was crying because we never got along, but this battle made me realize we love each other anyway. I saw blood and body parts on the bird. All the while, I waited to get shot by a stray bullet or lucky RPG round from the ground. I made it to Bagram Airfield, and I made my way to the hospital. I knew the battle was going to be with me for a long time. I agree that there is tremendous value in this for others. I have seen this in the men I have trained, and it gives me untold amounts of satisfaction to be approached after a firefight and have a soldier tell me, "I heard Sergeant McCaig's voice tell me to do this. He said it would happen." Unfortunately, at this time, I can only train a few men. I wish I could do it on a larger scale, to reach out and help more. I'm hoping that my promotions will allow me to do that in the Army or one day out of it. I really do like your breathing technique, the tactical breathing that you teach. Of course, if time permits, you should do it before taking a shot or shots. But what about when time doesn't permit? In long hours of fighting, you are not allowed this luxury. Hours go by, and every split second is life and death. What do you do then? Hell, sometimes you can't even do your basic fundamentals of marksmanship to pull the trigger. I believe thinking, instincts, and luck take control most of the time. I think that awareness is huge. There's great power in it. If someone would have told me what to expect, a heads up on what I would experience, seen, and felt, I could have better prepared my mind and body. Although you can train and prepare for most things in combat, I like talking about and training for the things that you can't train or prepare for. What is intense combat about? I'm not referring to regular combat, in which you are winning. I'm talking about the ones you are losing. If I had been told that some reactions to combat were normal, it would have been easier for me to push through them as they were happening. That way, I would have understood all the strange reactions and responses happening to my mind and body ahead of time. Honestly, I just hope that someone does find comfort knowing they are not a stranger out there, meaning they are not the only ones who have experienced this. We are just a very, very small minority, and it can be difficult to find comfort in that. I keep searching for that today. I struggle with anger, hypervigilance, and I break down in tears in my shower. I have random, unexplained, and hardly noticed, cold sweats, bad dreams, hands shaking, and frustration with everything at random moments. My nightmares are fewer now. I was also told that I suffer from delayed grievance. I keep myself so busy that I sometimes push myself to the point of physical and mental exhaustion. I do this every day until it's time to sleep. I like to say I am ambitious, and I want to do well at my job too, but that's really not all it is. I have to be careful, because it can affect my relationships with just about everyone. Writing does help me, and so does talking about it. All this sounds pretty bad, but I am actually doing really well, and I know I have the potential of being better than I was. Good things are happening in my life now, and I'm sure more are to come. After all, aren't the good things great now, after something like that horrible firefight? I like to think I am a warrior too. I know that God Himself saved me, and I feel an obligation to give back and pass on what I've experienced to people who need it. What I know is important and should be protected with integrity. Lieutenant Colonel Grossman, I enjoy knowing you see some value in my experience. I was hoping you would. This puts me at ease a little. Thank you for listening. I just ask one thing for the sake of our fallen heroes, me, my family, our country, the families of the fallen, our children, my unit, and our future, that the integrity of the story remains. This is a historic battle for our country. And it should be told right. It's a gift and tremendous responsibility to know these kind of things. So please, make us proud. Thank you. Author's note. At the time I communicated with Chris McCaig, he was a sergeant and paratrooper stationed in Italy, training his men for an upcoming combat deployment. He had received a Purple Heart for his injuries and a Bronze Star with V device for valor. He had been informed that this might be upgraded to a Silver Star. I think there are several valuable observations that can be made as we compare Commando Kelly's World War II narrative with McCaig's much more modern account of combat. First, we can observe that three quarters of a century after World War II, our frontline troops still do not have weapons that will not overheat under sustained fire. The basic hardware has not changed much at all. However, we can observe that a far higher proportion of the defenders were firing in this situation. I sincerely believe that this is a reflection on modern training techniques, with pop-up targets and realistic simulators, making killing a conditioned response, as outlined earlier in this audiobook, and in far more detail in my book on killing. Most of all, I think there is value in seeing how modern warriors can talk quite frankly about the role of fear in their experiences. Kelly's narrative was derived from his Medal of Honor citation, and this, the highest award for combat valor that our nation can bestow, is never given without extensive interviews, cross-checking, and fact-checking. This combat narrative was then published in the Saturday Evening Post, the most widely read national periodical of its time. We can have a high degree of confidence in the authority and veracity of this narrative. If there was anything incorrect or significantly misrepresenting the situation, it would have been exposed. But in Kelly's narrative, we don't get any impression of fear. I believe that fear much like that experienced by McCaig, must have existed. General Patton said, "Any man who tells you he's not afraid in combat is a liar." Although I think there are those rare individuals who are just too busy to be afraid. Such fear was acknowledged, but it was not talked about. Today I think we have a much deeper, more healthy, and valuable understanding of combat and the remarkable courage of men such as Kelly and McCaig when we begin to grasp the magnitude of the fear that they had to overcome in order to survive and be triumphant in combat. Courage in combat is not the absence of fear. Courage is controlling your fear, which, in my opinion, makes the achievement of these few true warriors all the more impressive and noble. And still more perspectives on the impact of the warrior. Another amazing example of the impact of a few true warriors can be found in aerial combat in World War II. In his excellent book, ME-10, author Martin Kaden writes that the Germans had 34 fighter pilots credited with over 150 kills in air-to-air combat. Eric Hartmann set the record with 352. Like Commando Kelly, these men were literally killing machines. Kaden writes, "These 34 men, according to the official German figures, shot down in aerial combat no less than 6,902 enemy aircraft. There were another 60 aces who the Germans say shot down between 100 and 150 aircraft each. Those 60 men accounted for another 7,095 machines. Thus, according to the official German records, 94 aces of the Luftwaffe accounted for 13,997 enemy machines shot down in aerial combat." Kaden makes it clear that the Germans did have some advantages that helped make this possible. Eric Rudorfer, on 6 November 1943, is credited with 13 kills in a single battle engagement that lasted 17 minutes. This is by no means an impossibility, since on 24 October 1944, Dave McCampbell, in a Hellcat, shot down 9 confirmed plus 2 probables when he roared into a flight of Japanese single-engine bombers, obviously flown by green pilots who just sat there while he flew, aimed, and fired to his heart's content. Another point to consider is that the German pilots sometimes flew from 2 to 5 or even more sorties in a single day, their home fields being only a stone's throw from the combat area. They flew almost constantly. Nevertheless, even with these advantages, Kaden says, nearly 14,000 planes shot down by less than 100 men. Such statistics make one stop and think. My co-author, Lauren Christensen, knows of a Medal of Honor recipient named Gino Merli, who single-handedly stopped an advance of 1,500 German troops in Bruyere, Belgium, during one long September night in World War II. On that horrific night in 1944, he and a buddy were assigned to cover an American retreat. The German attack was intense, and his buddy was soon killed. When the Germans approached again, Merrily feigned death, easily convincing the enemy since he was covered with his buddy's blood. When the Germans walked away, he slowly inched over to his machine gun and opened fire, mowing them all down. All through the night, the Germans sent out patrols as Merrily continued to feign death. Even when the Germans used their razor-sharp bayonets to roll him over. Every time they believed he was dead, and each time they walked away, he gunned them down. In the end, 52 German soldiers died that night. Here is one more powerful example. Have you seen that old movie, To Hell and Back, that depicts the heroic actions of Audie Murphy in World War II? After the war, Murphy went on to be an actor and starred in 44 movies, including To Hell and Back, in which he played himself. The son of poor Texas sharecroppers, Murphy began his service as an Army private. He quickly rose to staff sergeant and then was given a battlefield commission to second lieutenant. He was wounded 3 times, fought in 9 major campaigns across the European theater, and rose to national prominence when he became the most decorated American combat soldier of World War II. He won 33 awards and ribbons, including every decoration for valor that existed then, some of them more than once, including 5 decorations by France and Belgium. He received the military's highest award for bravery, the Medal of Honor, for actions in which he was credited with killing over 240 of the enemy, while wounding and capturing many others. At the end of the war, at the ripe old age of 21, he left the Army. The purpose of these examples is to demonstrate the tremendous impact that a tiny percentage of true warriors can have in combat. Their boldness, valor, initiative, and courage are vital to success and survival. The goal is to have many more of them. But where do we get such men? Some may occur naturally, but there can be no doubt that they can also be made, constructed, crafted, nurtured, and trained. Their role is not just in battle. We need warriors in peacetime as well. Justin Smith, a newspaper production manager in Pocatello, Idaho, demonstrated remarkable leadership and initiative in getting a special edition of his newspaper out while other people on his staff were still stunned into passivity in the immediate aftermath of the shock and horror of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. "It wasn't callousness," he said in a letter to me. "It was the necessity. I knew that people needed that newspaper in their hands to link them to other people and to help them deal with the horror. I have begun to learn that a warrior is not proven only in combat, but also in life. He lives by a code, not because codes are honorable or a fad, but because that is how a warrior thinks, and so it is how he lives. Combat is an extension of that code, not the source. The rigidity of military discipline reflects his mindset, and the two feed off each other. The man strengthened by the military, and the military strengthened by the man. His code in peacetime is the same as that in the military. Do your duty. Protect the weak. Protect the community. Face the bully. Stand tall. Stay aware. Think ahead. Be ready. Be loyal. Avoid aggression if possible, and, if not, win and win fully. Respect and honor are earned by actions, not granted by birth. There are 1,000 military codes spread throughout history. But I believe they all say the same thing at heart. Live with honor, and let not your death be borne by the pallbearers of disgrace, cruelty, weakness, and fear." Chapter 2, Stress Inoculation and Fear, Practicing to be Miserable. First-class training is the best form of welfare for the troops. The more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. Erwin Rommel. There is an old Army adage that says you don't have to practice being miserable. There is some truth in these words, but sometimes they are used as an excuse to avoid hard, rigorous training. Sometimes there is value in practicing to be miserable. Army Ranger School consisted of months of sleep and food deprivation in grueling environments of jungles, swamps, mountains, and deserts. After ranger school, almost everything else in life seemed easy by comparison. General Barry McCaffrey, best known as our nation's drug czar during the Clinton administration, told a story to a group of West Point cadets about his experiences in Vietnam that exemplifies what stress inoculation is all about. One day, he and a friend, a classmate from West Point in ranger school, were in Vietnam, lying behind a rice paddy dike as bullets screamed over their heads. At the peak of the battle, the general's friend turned to him and said, "Well, hell, at least we're not in ranger school." One of these days, scientists will probably have to pay for what they have done to all those poor little rats that were standing in the wrong line and got chosen for laboratory duty. Dr. Paul Whitesell tells about one such experiment conducted in the days before PETA, where scientists divided rats into three groups. Rats from the first group were dropped into a tub of water to see how long it took them to drown. According to this study, it took about 60 hours. The second group was first held upside down to give them a dose of stress. And when they eventually stopped kicking and squirming, i.e., they gave up and went into a parasympathetic backlash, the scientists dropped them in a tub of water. That group lasted about 20 minutes before they drowned. The third group was also held upside down until they stopped kicking and fighting. But instead of being dropped into the water, they were placed back into their cages. Several times that day, the same group, actually there was only one group left by now, was again picked up, held upside down until they quit kicking, and put back into their cages. Later that day, when the same rats were held upside down, they had figured out that this was just how the white coats got their kicks, and that it was no big deal. However, instead of being placed back in the comfort of their cages, they were dropped into the tub of water, where they swam for 60 hours. Unlike the second group of rats, the third group had been inoculated to the stressor. They had encountered it on two previous occasions and had always come out of the experience alive and triumphant. Being held upside down a third time was no big deal to them, and they were able to perform as if they had never even encountered the stressor. One report says that over a third of all police officers killed in combat did not defend themselves. The solution to this lies in training, hard training, that includes preparation for the possibility of being shot at and preparation for the possibility of being hit. Like our third group of rats, it is about being prepared ahead of time for the stress of combat. Let's look at three training principles that are critical for preparing the warrior for the harsh reality of life and death combat. Principle 1. Never kill a warrior in training. Many training exercises involve trainees getting killed when they err in the exercise. "You shouldn't have done that. You're dead now." This type of training only trains you to die. "I'm dead," you think, when another trainee or a trainer shoots you with a paint bullet or pretends to stab you. This is wrong. A trainer should never declare his students to be dead. And if a student ever states that he is dead, the right answer is, "No, you aren't dead. I don't give you permission to die. I don't train people to die. I train them to live." I know of gangbangers who have sucked up a dozen 9mm rounds and drove on to survive. If they can do it, you can too. When a training scenario does not go the way you want it to, then do it again. But do not ever think you are dead in an exercise. If you are practicing knife defenses and your training partner stabs you, do not think you failed and that you are finished. I know of a little old lady who was stabbed 20 times and then crawled to the phone, dialed 911, and lived to tell about it. Never, ever give up after being shot or stabbed. Do not train yourself to die, and do not train other warriors to die. Ken Murray, author of Training at the Speed of Life and co-founder of Simmunition, the company that developed the most widely used brand of paint ammunition, says to his officers who have been shot in training, "Yeah, you're hit, but you're sure as hell not done. Now finish this bastard." His officers hear this so often in his training program that they take him into battle with them. In the event they are really hit, he wants them to hear his words, "Yeah, you're hit, but you're sure as hell not done," and then do what needs to be done. Ken says that stress-inducing simulation training places an obvious fork in a person's survival psychology pathway at the point of projectile impact. If the trainee is conditioned to stop when he is hit, as if the scenario is over, he programs an undesirable and potentially self-destructive action into his mind. Ken Murray points out that it is a much more complex dynamic than simply demotivating trainees when they are told they are dead or allow themselves to believe they are dead. Ken points to the research done by Mike Spick in The ACE Factor, a book that studies the salient differences between aces and turkeys in air combat. Spick's research clearly demonstrates that the survivability in air combat increases dramatically after a pilot's first five successful air combat engagements. These pilots become nearly undefeatable, except when faced with a pilot of a higher level of experience. This jibes well with Martin Kaden's book, ME-10, that tracked the exploits of 34 pilots credited with 6,902 enemy aircraft being shot down. Murray states that in law enforcement, most officers will never get to their decisive five engagements. As recognized by Russ Claggett, many officers leave law enforcement after their first live-fire engagement. And the political winds of today would certainly breathe foul on patrol officers that would get into five shootings unless they were on a specialty unit. In the military world, there may be warriors who get five engagements. But what of the price that is paid by all those who do not pass those first five tests? Today, we have the tools to create what I have termed pre-battle veterans, individuals with the survival skills of a veteran warrior, but without the tragic cost of real combat. Murray believes that when properly structured, reality-based training can provide warriors with those essential five experiences necessary to ensure a high level of survivability. But he cautions that things can take a horrible turn if students are given the experience of losing. Even in those simulated encounters, it can literally take the student in the wrong direction, creating turkeys rather than eagles. It also creates a neurological deficiency that can be extremely difficult to overcome. Murray quotes Coslin and Koenig in their groundbreaking book, Wet Mind, New Cognitive Neuroscience. Conditioned fear can be extremely difficult to extinguish. It cannot be eliminated through passive deterioration or even active attempts to do so. Even if it seems that it has been extinguished, stress may cause it to reappear. What this means is that giving warriors the experience of losing in a simulation actually begins to condition a risk aversion pathway in the brain to which they may turn during similar experiences in the future. They may actually stop fighting and give up, as they were programmed to do in training. This is why Murray will never let a student out of the training arena without ensuring that they are the decisive winner, not through the role player giving anything away that is not earned, but rather by forcing, if necessary, the student to engage once they have been engaged. Even if they argue that they have been hit in a manner that is unsurvivable, Murray says that there are only three logical conclusions to a scenario. Everyone makes nice and goes home. Someone surrenders, or the bad guy chooses a lethal force encounter. Whether or not the student is shot, a lethal force scenario is not over until the student successfully engages the suspect, has sought a position of advantage, cover, has called for assistance, and is waiting while covering the suspect. No other conclusion is acceptable, since no other conclusion will provide a warrior with a survival experience that can take them into future battles. Shot ain't dead, says Murray. And we have a moral obligation to our warriors to give them the survival five experiences, to provide them with every possible physical and psychological advantage during a lethal force encounter. Anything less is unacceptable. Principle 2. Try to never send a loser off your training site. Yes, there will be a certain percentage of people who never grasp the training. But your goal as a professional is to keep that percentage to a bare minimum. It is easy to design a force-on-force paint bullet scenario that makes every trainee look like an idiot. But all that proves is that the trainers are jerks. Ken Murray calls this masturbation. Its only purpose is to act as a form of self-gratification for the trainer. But suppose you are a trainer and you put a warrior through a scenario where he fails. And then you put him through it again and he succeeds. First, you revealed a flaw in his armor, and then you taught him how to shore up that weakness. In so doing, you brought him out the other end of the exercise as a superior warrior. If there is not sufficient time and resources to run the exercise again, then just toss him a softball. Let him knock it out of the park. Your goal is to send winners out the door. Principle 3. As a trainer, never talk trash about your students. A warrior trainer is a sensei, a professional, who has confidentiality standards like a priest or a doctor. Say a doctor conducts a physical examination where he checks a police officer from top to bottom. Do you think at night over beer he tells other doctors about the officer and laughs about the poor guy's droopy butt? No, because he is a professional. If you are a trainer and you laugh about Smith's failures when having a beer with other warriors, how do you think the others are going to take it? They might laugh at your story, but inside they think you are a jerk and that it will be a cold day in hell before they'd let you see them fail. Friends tease each other. SWAT teams tease each other. It comes with the territory. If you are a leader, however, you are not permitted to play the teasing game. You never joke about your trainees' failures, but you do brag about their achievements. Your entire repertoire is to talk about what went right. And when you say these things over beer with your peers, they will want you to brag about them the next time. When word gets out that this is the type of trainer you are, people will no longer avoid training, but will want to be there because of the environment you have created. The fundamental rule of warrior leadership is to punish in private and praise in public. Report all failures and problems up the chain of command, but report success to everyone. Maybe you were publicly punished and embarrassed at one time, and now you despise the person who did it to you. Perhaps there was a time when a leader called you into his office and told you in private that you did a great job yesterday. While you appreciate the nice comments, you wish he had said them in front of everyone. It's only fair. If you had messed up, everyone would know. Create an environment in which your people want to train and be inoculated. Do not kill your warriors. Do not send losers off the training site. Do not talk trash about your students. Punish in private, praise in public. This is the way that a warrior trainer, a sensei, creates a training environment in which the warrior spirit is nurtured and his warriors want to train. A word on fear, vacillating between four stages. Herein lies the problem. Fear is unpredictable and inconsistent from one person to the next, or even the same person in a second but similar circumstance. Fear is like a ghost in the night. You can feel its presence, but you cannot grab it and beat it into submission. Bruce Siddle, Warrior Science. Dr. Paul Whitesell is a brilliant psychologist, counselor, Vietnam veteran, and law enforcement officer who trains police officers in leadership and warrior spirit. He draws from the work of Lord Moran to teach his students that there are four kinds of fear. First, there are those who know no fear and they do the job. These are rare people because most know fear. Usually they are caught by surprise and the situation is over so quickly they did not have time to be afraid. There are those who know fear and no one knows it, and they do the job. There are those who know fear and everyone sees it and smells it, but it does not matter because the job gets done. There are those who know fear, and everyone knows it, because they fail to do the job. Human beings usually vacillate between all four stages, with their propensity towards one or another. We all have bad days and good days. Allow yourself the flux. Do not destroy yourself because of a bad day, and do not destroy others because they had one. Name your favorite baseball pitcher or football quarterback. Do they ever have bad days? Would you judge them for the rest of their lives on one bad day, one bad game? Instead, do as most professional ball players do when they throw a bad game or have a bad season. They learn from it. And when the next season rolls around, they are usually all the better because of it. My co-author won 50 trophies during his competitive years in the martial arts. Today, when Christensen students ask him about those wins, he is quick to tell them that while he did indeed win 50 karate competitions, he entered in well over 100. It was always fun to win, he tells him, and bring home big, gaudy trophies for his den. But it is those empty places on the shelves where there are no trophies, places that represent his losses, that were the most valuable to him. When he won, he would bask in the glory. But when he had a bad day and lost, he always analyzed why and tried to learn from his mistakes so that the next time he competed stronger and wiser. As Dr. Weitzel puts it, do not destroy yourself over the bad days. Take pride in your good ones and strive to constantly improve. While it is acceptable to have a bad day, it is unacceptable not to train, not to try to get better, not to use the resources available to make sure that what caused that bad day never happens to you again. It is all about prior preparation, preparation for warriorhood. Chapter 3, Sucking Up Bullets and Continuing to Fight. You've never lived until you've almost died. In my mind, I'm never going to die in no ghetto. Absolutely never. If a man tries to punch me in the head, the fight is on. If he cuts me, the fight is on. If I'm shot, the fight is on. I'm not losing no fight to no scumbag out there in no ghetto. Period. That's it. No son of a bitch out there is going to get me. The only way he gets me is to cut my head off, and I mean that. I'll fight you while I got a breath left in me. I don't think any of those animals in the street can beat me. I've gone that way for 18 years of street service, street duty, and that's the way I'm going to keep on going. You don't lose the fight. Jim Phillips, Caliber Press Video, Surviving Edge Weapons, 1988. Warrior attitudes before combat, looking forward to it, and getting it over with. To some, combat was an empowering event and a learning experience that made them stronger in uncountable ways. To others, it became a debilitating and life-altering event that sent them into an unrecoverable psychological tailspin. Steve Tarani and Damon Fay, Contact Weapons, Lethality and Defense. If you are in a war, you are a warrior. There are only two types on the battlefield. Warriors and victims. Sheep avoid the battle or refuse to participate, but warriors seem to have two basic attitudes as they go into combat. One group appears to honestly look forward to it. The second group doesn't really want to do it, but since it has to be done, their attitude is, let's get it over with. Both are perfectly healthy and appropriate responses. Drew Brown is a reporter for Knight Rider newspapers, who served in combat with the 1st Ranger Battalion in the invasion of Panama in 1989. He was with the U.S. forces preparing to invade Iraq in 2003 when he sent me an email with this astute observation. I know that a lot of what I'm hearing is bravado. You often hear things like, I just want to get in there, get it over with, and get the job done. Or, it's just part of the job. Both of which indicate a more detached view. How does one explain these two attitudes from a psychological point of view? Do you really buy it when you read about soldiers who say they want to go to war? What is driving these men? And also, how does one account for the more detached attitude? I told him that I sincerely believe that a sizable number of warriors really do want to see combat. Some of this might be mindless bravado, but some of it is not. Many of these individuals are mature, level-headed warriors. They are like good football players who scrimmage and practice endlessly, but never get to play a game. Well, there is a game now, and these warriors want to be in it. I think these individuals must be thinking like Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., when he said, "I think that, as life is passion and action, it is required of a man that he should share the passion and action of his time at peril of being judged not to have lived." As I train warriors around the world, traveling in my endless odyssey, I often get to spend time in police cars with law enforcement officers who drive me from the airport to the city where our training session is to take place. One very senior state trooper told me once, as he was driving me across a vast Midwestern state in the middle of the night at 120 miles per hour, that there were two things he wanted before he retired. One was to have a car fast enough to hit a crow. Troopers do a lot of high-speed driving and have an interesting sense of humor about it. And the other was to get into a gunfight. He was not embarrassed or full of false bravado about it. He just simply stated the fact that he had trained for a lifetime, and he wanted to see how he would do. I trained many members of the Special Operations community, SWAT, SEALs, Rangers, Green Beret, etc., and I have found this attitude to be common with them. In ages past, it was quite common in popular poetry to speak of finding a degree of pleasure or satisfaction in battle. The poem Into Battle by Julian Grenfell, which I placed as the dedication of this book, is an example of poetic writing seldom seen today, a poem that speaks of the joy of battle. Here is another one with a similar theme. "I shall not die alone, alone, but kin to all the powers, as merry as the ancient sun and fighting like the flowers. How white their steel, how bright their eyes. I love each laughing knave. Cry high and bid him welcome to the banquet of the brave. Yea, I will bless them as they bend and love them where they lie, when on their skulls the sword I swing falls shattering from the sky. The hour when death is like a light and blood is like a rose, you have never loved your friends, my friends, as I shall love my foes." G.K. Chesterton, The Last Hero. All this might be dismissed as mindless romanticizing by those who have never been in combat. But those who have been there often express their desire to go back into harm's way. It is politically correct to say that there is nothing good about war, and no one who has seen it would want to do it again. This is the obligatory nod that everyone must give when talking about the possibility of going to war, and from one perspective, it is completely true. But I know many veterans who disagree. Some Vietnam veterans, for example, stayed for 2, 3, 4, 5, and in one case that I know of, 6 tours. And every one of these individuals who I have information about is a perfectly healthy, functional human being who does not appear to have paid any significant psychological cost for his years of combat. They are the sheepdogs that we examine in greater detail later. They liked it. It is not uncommon for police officers who have been in gunfights to compete for a position on their SWAT teams, where they have the greatest chance to see even more action. And it is common for SWAT team members to spend decades in those dangerous positions. Many of the SWAT and military special operations forces I have worked with are sincere and open when communicating the pleasure they derive from combat. These elite SWAT and special ops operators have dedicated themselves to a lifetime of combat because they like it and they are good at it. Few sane people would want to be in the trenches of World War I, to name just one example. But many individuals wanted very much to go to Afghanistan with the special forces to get some payback for the terrorist attacks on September 11th. As Bob Posey, a veteran police officer and trainer in Washington State, said, "They are looking for a just good fight, sniffing the breeze, pissing on the trees, being the sheepdog. Or, as Sir Walter Scott put it, they are seeking the stern joy which warriors feel and foemen worthy of their steel. I received an email from Monty Gold, a career cop, a SWAT operator, and trainer, who is also a sergeant at the U.S. Army Reserves. We met when we were both training Finnish law enforcement officers in Helsinki. He had this to say when he learned that he was too old to be accepted into the U.S. Army Special Forces. Damn the bad luck. I wanted time on target. Trust me, I'm like a goddamn peacemaker. Every time I show up in the theater of operations, peace breaks out and I get sent home. I feel like Mother Teresa instead of some kind of action hero. I'm going to start carrying a Bible and Jehovah Witness handouts. They need me in the Middle East. All hostilities would cease overnight. The Arabs and the Jews would be friends, and I would get an express ticket home. This was my response to him. There are people who say that no one wants to go to war, and that a soldier hates war more than anyone, and I'm sure they are sincere. But I know a lot of people who would beg to differ. And best I can tell, there ain't nothing wrong with them. Sir John Keegan, in his superb classic book, The Face of Battle, wrote, "We must take account of the undoubted willingness of some men at all times to risk, even apparently to enjoy, extreme danger." Keegan used as an example Corporal Lofty King, a British commando in World War II. King's commander said this about him: "He genuinely enjoyed fighting and looked happiest, indeed inspired, in battle." Keegan said Lofty King is a significant figure whose outline can be discerned in the thick of the fighting on many battlefields. Comparing him to the French Lieutenant Legros, who was nicknamed the Enforcer at the Great Gate of Hougoumont during the Battle of Waterloo, whose power to impose his superior will on his comrades lends support to one suspicion that, after all, battle is to the strong, that without the presence of the Lofty Kings and the Legros, most battlefields would empty of soldiers at the firing of the first salvos. Keegan goes on to say that there are moral consolations with which battle compensates the soldier. It would be foolish to deny that there are compensations for its cruelties. The thrill of comradeship, the excitements of the chase, the accelerations of surprise, deception, and ruse de guerre, the exultation of success, the sheer fun of prankish irresponsibility. Colonel Jack Beach, a combat veteran who was the head of the psychology program at West Point, talks about a post-combat malaise, and he puts it this way: "Whether you are in the heat of battle or just in the theater of combat, I believe, for most people, just being there is the most intense, at least prolonged intense, experience they ever have. In many ways, it's a very simple existence. Many of the cares of the ordinary life do not intrude. However, you are completely focused on a mission that you feel is vital and that you are contributing to. You feel very alive and form deep bonds of intimacy with those about you. Unless, when you return, you come back to a very meaningful work, you hunger for a return to that." This is not intended in any way to speak ill of the veterans who would strongly disagree with these warriors who have found a degree of pleasure in battle. Indeed, those who are willing to point out that war is hell, in General William Tecumseh Sherman's words, were once the individuals who were being politically incorrect in their time. As Henry Van Dyke put it in a poem about Sherman, "This is the soldier brave enough to tell the glory-dazzled world that war is hell." The point here is that there are conflicting opinions on this matter. As to the "let's get it over with" attitude, I would submit that this is also a mature, level-headed, and healthy response. Most people faced with a dirty, unpleasant job that has to be done would have a similar attitude. John Keegan, in Fields of Battle, put it this way: The United States continues to elude me. If I understand it at all, it is through the strange profession that has shaped my life, the study of war. War is repugnant to the people of the United States, yet it is war that has made their nation, and it is through their power to wage war that they dominate the world. Americans are proficient at war in the same way that they are proficient at work. It is a task, sometimes a duty. Americans have worked at war since the 17th century to protect themselves from the Indians, to win their independence from George III, to make themselves one country, to win the whole of their continent, to extinguish autocracy and dictatorship in the world outside. It is not their favored form of work. Left to themselves, Americans build, cultivate, bridge, dam, canalize, invent, teach, manufacture, think, write, lock themselves into struggle with the eternal challenges that man has chosen to confront, and with an intensity not known elsewhere on the globe. Bidden to make war their work, Americans shoulder the burden with intimidating purpose. There is, I have said, an American mystery, the nature of which I only begin to perceive. If I were obliged to define it, I would say it is the ethos of work as an end in itself. War is a form of work, and America makes war, however reluctantly, however unwillingly, in a particularly workmanlike way. I do not love war, but I love America. Keegan gives credit and honor to the American fighting man, but as a graduate of the British Army Staff College, and after a lifetime of working with warriors of many nations and cultures, I would say that this applies to the British soldier and to many other professional warriors around the world and throughout history. I think that either response, wanting to go, or a workmanlike desire to do it well and get it over with, is fine. And it is not for us to judge those who feel either way. These are warriors who are willing to answer the summons of the trumpet and enter into the realm of combat. Their response, I believe, is quite healthy. Those who do not face combat with eagerness or steely determination are probably the ones who, as Steve Tirani and Damon Fay put it in Contact Weapons, will have a debilitating and life-altering event that will send them into an unrecoverable psychological tailspin. Taking hits and driving on, do they make them like that anymore? Heroism is the brilliant triumph of the soul over the flesh. Henri Frédéric Amiel, from his journal. Once you have made the decision to enter into combat, the thought of getting injured becomes one of your worst fears. Let us confront this fear. I want to share with you one of my favorite stories of survival, a true tale about a mountain man named Hugh Glass from back in the early days of mountain expeditions. Glass was badly mauled by a bear, and it looked like he was not going to make it. The others there that day decided to leave young Jim Bridger with Hugh to wait for him to die. But the old cuss was just too mean to die, and it was a long time before he slipped into a coma. Bridger figured then that Glass was dead, so he dug a shallow grave, piled a few rocks on him, and left. Hugh Glass was still alive, though, so you can imagine that being buried angered him a bit. After he managed to crawl out of his grave, he worked his way downstream, eventually making it to the Missouri River, where he floated along, clinging to chunks of wood and living off the land. Finally, months later, he made it to St. Louis, where he told stories about wolves coming up to him and licking maggots off his wounds. The first thing old Hugh did after he was rested and recovered was to buy a gun. One version of the story says he bought a knife. Then he sat back to recover from his ordeal and to wait. When Jim Bridger and the other men showed up, Hugh caught up with Bridger and held his gun on it. Hugh thought for a while about the situation, eventually coming to the conclusion that Jim Bridger was too young to die, so he let him go. Do they make warriors like Hugh Glass anymore? Here is a man mauled by a bear, left to die and buried alive. He climbed out of his grave, crawled from Montana to St. Louis, and when he